Our true crime podcast deals with sensitive issues, including some that little ears shouldn't hear. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And you're listening to
Our True Crime Podcast.
This is Kim, your friendly neighborhood ER nurse. I'm the host of People Are Wild, the only podcast that claims to bring medical entertainment, medutainment, on a weekly basis. I can be found on your favorite podcast listening app, iTunes and Google Play, and you could talk to me on Twitter at People Are Wild.
Woohoo!
Hey, I've got some shout outs before we start.
Let's do them.
First one, Billie Jean loves our podcast.
Billie Jean! Anne hates her singing, apparently.
Yeah, no, I don't think she hates it. I think she was just a little bit surprised.
I never made fourth grade choir. I was the only one not to make it. I'm still bitter, Miss Hoffert.
Whatever. Other ones we want to give a shout out, Kimmy, thank you.
Kimmy!
Andy, I'm glad you made it home safe.
Andy.
And our good girl, Missy B.
Missy B.
And then some five-star reviews on the iTunes app. Sorry.
Ooh.
Little mind iTunes. Break there. Crazy Girl.
Crazy Girl.
And Jax.
Jax.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. It really boosts our LPE.
Low podcast esteem. Whatever. Right?
Low podcast esteem. That's correct. Anyway,
we suffer from LPE a lot.
A lot, but when you guys help us by leaving reviews or giving us huge shout outs on Twitter, we love it. DM us your address or anything you want.
Not anything. Just your address.
DM us your addy and we would love to send you some stickers that we have. They're awesome stickers.
And a new car.
Matchbox.
Joke never gets old.
All right.
Jen, what are we going to talk about today?
We are going to talk about... Well, I'll tell you what.
Yes, please do.
I have been focusing on things that happen in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not going to do Missouri.
Okay.
We're not even going to do the United States.
Oh.
We are going to go all the way on the other side of the world.
Ooh.
To Australia.
Awesome. Down on down, mate.
Boy, you just ruined that.
Lost the whole country of listeners. Sorry about that, folks. I like to do bad accents and they all sound the same.
Yeah, pretty much. I know we have the warning in the front of the episode about how it's disturbing.
Listener discretion is advised.
Exactly. This one is quite disturbing. It was really hard to write about. I will let you know when it gets closer. So if you want to turn it off, skip this one. Totally cool.
Fast forward.
Totally cool. But I will warn you before I get to that part. Okay.
Noted.
So this case comes from the coastal city of Greenough in West Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Greenough is a historical settlement about 250 miles or 40 kilometers north of Perth.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 11 miles or 15 kilometers south of Geraldton by way of the Brand Highway.
Mm-hmm.
Very small town. Actually, as of the 2016 census, there were roughly 262 people in the little shire of Greenough.
Oh my goodness, it's tiny.
It's very tiny. Actually, everything, it's almost like it's its own town, but everything is run by Geraldton area. Okay. Basically, it's a historical settlement, so the buildings date to the second half of the 19th century.
Oh.
Lots of tourism, mostly museums, stuff like that. So it's a big tourist destination. Another cool thing mm-hmm. about Greenough. The coastal winds are so strong that they're known for these wind-swept trees that are bent at a full 90 degrees down to the ground because of the coastal winds.
When we lived in Palmdale, California, shout out Palmdale, we lived on a golf course out there. Mm-hmm. You know where you are if you're listening from out there. All our trees were sideways because of that reason.
Yeah, these were like almost to the ground. Very cool.
Yep.
Besides the settlement, you know, the historical aspect and the trees... Greenough had been able to stay out of the public eye until 1993. And that's when what is called Australia's most heinous crime was committed.
Ooh.
And we're going to talk about the McKenzie family massacre.
Oof.
It's bad.
I don't like it already.
Okay, we'll start with the mother. Karen McKenzie's friends and family remember a bubbly, happy person. Even as a child, Karen's mom remembers her being carefree and happy. She was always laughing. She loved school. But as it happens, as a teen, Karen developed a wild side.
Mm-hmm.
She started experimenting with recreational drugs.
Oh, not good.
And by the time Karen was 15 years old, she was pregnant. She had her first child, a boy named Daniel. Now, Karen tried very hard to raise her son. She even moved out on her own. But of course, at 15...
It's babies raising babies.
It's difficult. I mean, it's difficult as an adult, a single mom adult. I couldn't imagine being 15 trying to live, take care of a kid.
Nope.
She moved out on her own, but it proved too difficult for her. And so just before Daniel turned two, she did what she thought was best, and she gave Daniel to her mother, who lived in Queensland. So her mother raised Daniel.
Okay.
Then later, when Karen was 24, she meets and falls in love with a man, Andrew Allen. They have two daughters, and then it goes south. So that relationship didn't last.
Okay. That happens.
In 1991, Karen found this small, run-down house that was in bad need of repairs, and it was right outside of Greniff. She was barely able to afford this farmhouse, and it was isolated. It was way far out off the main highway, way down this long road, but she did buy it, and she started repairing it, and she was making this lovely home for her and her kids. Karen cared very deeply for her kids, and everybody considered her a good mother. She tried very hard to give her kids a good life, like all mothers do. Most mothers do, right?
Most, yes.
She was young, and she liked to go out and have a good time. And a lot of people in her social circle were involved in the drug scene around the area.
And that little tiny town had a drug scene?
Well, it was only 20 minutes from Geraldton.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a drug.
Drugs are everywhere.
Exactly.
Bad people stay away.
I'm not sure how involved she was or how involved they were. I don't know if they were just recreational users. I don't know what it was, but drugs were involved somehow. So in 1993, Karen McKenzie, who was 31 at the time, decides that she wants Daniel, who is 16, to come live with her and to get to know his sisters, who are Amara, she was 7, and Katrina was 5. Daniel couldn't wait for the opportunity. He was so excited to finally get to move out to his mom. His grandmother bought him a bus ticket from Queensland to Greniff. It's a long journey. Seriously, it's 1,830 miles.
Oof.
Or 2,950 kilometers. Roughly, it's a 50-hour bus ride.
Terrible.
And I'm bad at math, so that whole thing doesn't
work. I'm very impressed with your kilometer mile,
Thank you, Wikipedia.
I know, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, don't say that. You did that in your head.
Oh, yeah. He was excited for this new life. He had previously dropped out of school, and he was going to, he re-enrolled in school, and he was going to try to make a go of it and make his life better. So it was a great opportunity for the entire family.
Right.
So on February 19th, 1993, Daniel was finally settled in with his mother and the two girls. He was home, able to watch the girls. So Karen decided, you know, she had had a bad time. She had just gotten out of a relationship, a serious relationship. And she was going to go to a friend's house to a party they were having in Geraldton, which, like I said, was about 15, 20 minutes away.
And he's 16. And he's 16, so he can totally babysit.
Yeah. He's totally old enough to watch kids. So she goes to the party, and she stays out until 5 a.m. I can't remember being out at a party until 5 a.m.
That's not okay, though.
Well...
Yeah, but come on.
She's letting loose, having fun. I think
I have become my mother when I say, what is there to do at 5 a.m. in the morning?
No, she was with friends. She was at a house. Who are we to judge? We've all done stupid things, right?
Speak for yourself, Jennifer.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So she stayed at the party until 5 a.m., and then a friend of hers drove her home. So that was on Friday. Okay, now this is where it's going to start getting graphic, and the violence starts to happen, so you might want to skip ahead. A couple days later, barely even 48 hours... tragedy starts. So Monday night, or actually it should be Monday morning, February 22nd at 3 a.m., a car slowly drives down the long road to Karen's house.
And this is not populated.
So no, it's isolated.
Uncommon.
I mean, exactly. Okay. And the road to get to her house, it's hard to find. Everyone is asleep besides Daniel. Daniel goes outside to see who could be coming out at that time, which, how brave is that? No.
That's a no.
At 16? No. At my age? No.
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
Nope.
So Daniel goes outside to see who it is. The driver steps out of the car like he's going to greet Daniel. But instead, without warning, The driver attacks Daniel, knocks him to the ground, and starts to brutally beat him. Once the driver is sure that Daniel is dead, he goes into Karen's house. Once inside, the killer finds Karen sleeping on the living room floor. He walks across the room, takes out a tomahawk, which is a small hatchet, like axe.
Did he bring that with him?
He brought it.
Ugh.
So he takes out the tomahawk, and he brings it down repeatedly on Karen's face and head. Karen's body then starts to convulse.
So was she sleeping, I guess, when
she
he attacked
was sleeping.
Her?
Karen then starts to convulse, which causes her to roll over on her stomach.
Mm-hmm.
The killer then continues to hit Karen on the head and neck with the small axe until she can no longer move.
Oh, it's brutal.
The killer then proceeds to go into Karen's room and just ransack it to look for drugs. He goes through all the closets, the drawers, all the while Karen's half-naked body lays on the floor while the pool of blood just goes all about her.
Ugh.
So instead of finding drugs, the killer finds some hand lotion, which he then takes.
I don't know where this is going, but I do not.
This is where it gets back.
Like it. Mm-hmm. Ew.
He brings it over to Karen's body. He then kneels down and pulls Karen's body into a crouching position. Remember, she's on her stomach.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then using the hand lotion as a lubricant, he begins to rape Karen's lifeless body.
Oh, my God.
Afterwards, he covers Karen's bashed-in head with a blanket and leaves her body the way he positioned it. The killer then slowly leaves Karen's bedroom and quietly walks into 7-year-old Amara's room.
Okay, I think I'm going to have to pause this one.
Exactly. Amara is still asleep. He then proceeds to brutally attack and kill her. When he's finished, the killer heads over to 5-year-old Katrina's room and kills her. From what I read, our only consolation to this was that Katrina died very quickly.
Ugh.
She didn't suffer. And honestly, these murders were so disturbing that the Supreme Court of Western Australia has ordered all details of the attack to be kept secret.
Really?
He's closed all documents and they're not allowed out to the public at all.
That's a blessing, really.
After the entire family had been slaughtered, the killer walked into the bathroom covered in the blood of all 4 victims.
Mm-hmm.
He then proceeds to wash the blood off of his body, being careful not to leave any clues. He then takes the tomahawk that he's washed and the hand lotion that he used,
mm-hmm.
and he walks to his car and then he leaves.
Did he take that stuff with him, the tomahawk and the lotion?
He took the tomahawk and he left no clues.
Ugh.
He was very careful.
See, I was going to say, was he wasted on drugs? But if he had that much sense to do all that, I'm thinking, no. Okay,
okay.
Go ahead.
Just remember you said that, okay?
I guess.
Okay.
Ugh.
Later on that Monday morning on February 22nd, or probably around 10 or so, a married couple who were friends with Karen are on their way to her house because they had already planned to help her around the house with repairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
As they got closer to the house,
they see Daniel's body.
And they're like, well, they had just met Daniel, you know, a couple weeks before. And they thought, well, maybe he's playing some kind of weird joke. So the husband walks over to get a closer look. He can't even be sure that it's actually Daniel.
That's terrible.
The body's so messed up. He's in shock, and he turns slowly to go into the house. He wants to make sure that everything's okay. And he calls out for Karen, but there's no answer. And then, of course, the man's wife is still in the car, and she starts freaking out, saying, you know, we've got to go get help. I would, too. I mean,
yeah,
you see this brutally.
I don't.
They go off to find help. Now, remember, isolated place, long road. All the other houses are far back from the road. So they even jump fences and run
to try to get help
to these other houses. But nobody's home. They ended up having to go into that small town to a pottery museum to call for the police.
Oh.
At 11 a.m., detectives from the CIB, which is the Criminal Investigation Branch, and uniformed officers arrive at the scene. Since they already knew about the body outside,
mm-hmm.
their main concern was for the welfare of the family, because they knew the family was inside. They weren't sure if the killer was still inside or if the family was even in there. They didn't know what happened. So after they checked Daniel and made sure that
he was gone.
He couldn't,
right.
didn't need any help, the first detective goes and enters the house. And that's when he sees Karen's body. It's still in that crouching position.
Unreal.
With a bloody blanket over her head. As they checked the rest of the house, they found the tiny bodies of Amara and Katrina. These experienced, hard, gruff detectives say without a doubt that it was the most horrendous crime scene that they had ever had the misfortune to see.
I can totally understand that.
They even had to go outside to compose themselves before they could even go back in and secure the scene in the surrounding areas. Right. It was that difficult. I couldn't imagine it.
No.
I'd probably leave. I couldn't do it.
I would be physically
sick. Not
with
those babies. Nope. No. So the day was extremely hot and windy. Remember the bendy trees?
Uh-huh.
So the first thing that the detectives did was take pictures outside the house. And they were trying to figure out why Daniel's body was outside. Like, was he inside and the killer attacked and he tried to escape? So, that, you know, they were trying to figure out all that kind of stuff. So they made sure to get lots of pictures of where Daniel was, all the tire prints, all the shoe prints and other evidence. So once the outside areas were secured, a huge team of detectives swarmed the house and they start looking for anything that could lead to the identity of the man responsible for this horrible thing. They worked tirelessly throughout the day and most of the night, carefully examining, bagging, tagging evidence that they collected.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that they thought they could,
they
did. Finally, at 4 a.m. Tuesday, the bodies of Karen and the kids were flown to Perth for the postmortem examination. And it was only then that the detectives go home. But they didn't leave the scene entirely. They placed armed guards at the house to protect anything that they might have missed. Then, with hardly any sleep, at 7 a.m., they came back. And they brought with them lots of uniformed officers, along with tons of SESs, which is state emergency services. It took 7 days to go through the house and the surrounding land.
Well, it's pretty brutal, you said, right?
It was very brutal, but they
rule. Like very rural. Yes. I'm from Missouri. I don't talk right.
You don't talk real well. But yeah, it took 7 days. That's how thorough they were. On the third day of the evidence collection, the detectives searched for fingerprints. They came across a partial palm print. And it was the side of the right hand from the bottom of the palm to the tip of the little finger.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed interesting. So they used a method called iodine fuming to get the print. You do?
Of course.
Well, for those of you that don't, what they do is they heat up iodine chemicals. Then they put the fumes on the surfaces and then it will react with the natural fatty content. Once they got that palm print, not only did they photograph it, they actually took the palm print out of the wall. They cut the drywall around it. And the reason why they cut it out, even though they took a picture, back then they didn't have the instant cameras they wanted
digital.
A good
print.
So if they used the wet film or the regular 35 millimeter, you wouldn't know how detailed the photograph was going to be. So they took the whole print.
Makes sense.
Uh-huh. Because they wanted to make sure that they could make a proper ID when the time came.
And I hope the time came.
Well, then the forensic team that they brought in brings a special ultraviolet polylight to go over the area again to catch if there's anything that they missed. The polylight has an extremely powerful beam and the many colored filters can expose different substances that you can't see to the human eye.
Mm-hmm.
On the back of the door in the same room where the partial palm print was found, they found greasy fingerprints. They showed up very well under the polylight. So they took the door off the hinges because they weren't messing around and they sent it to Perth for experts to look at. Once the door gets to Perth, a research chemist actually is the one that gets to look at the prints. The chemist was told that the lotion, because it was so greasy, that it was probably a product called sorbeline cream. Sorbeline is the Australian version of Vaseline.
So was this the lotion?
Yes. The chemist breaks down the cream to try to find the chemical compound because everything has its specific compound, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they begin to test all the creams and lotions that they have in their little library at the Criminal Investigation Center. They find a lotion that's a close match, but not exact. They also don't understand why they can't find a match with all the lotions and creams in her house.
Yeah.
And they never even, I guess it didn't dawn on them that the killer might have taken it or anything.
Right. Because that would be weird.
That would be very weird.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't think about that. While working trying to get the prints sorted out, they begin to think, why would the killer have left oily prints in the first place? They then recalled some past sexual assault cases they had worked on where this type of lotion was used as a lubricant. So immediately, this chemical research calls the pathologist where the bodies were and asked if a swab of the genitals had been taken. And it had. The swabs were found to have the same substance as the prints.
Mm-hmm.
They knew the prints belonged to the killer.
Good. Let's get them.
Now the police know that the killer had to have known Karen or had to have been out at her house before because her house wasn't very easy to find.
Was he at the party with them?
They first contact Karen's ex-husband, Andrew Allen. But he had been trapped up north by heavy rains, which made traveling on any roads impossible.
And that, he was the father of the two girls, right?
He was the father of the two girls, right? Yeah,
I would hope that would not be him.
No. He had the rock solid alibi. He didn't do it. Two witnesses, I guess neighbors maybe, mm-hmm. had said that they told police that there were two cars at Karen's house on Sunday. So they thought that the attack could have been some sort of gang-related revenge. Because remember, Karen was a small-time drug user and she hung around with people that could be involved right. in the drug scene. The police looked into the bikers in the area and also the Asian gang that had moved in. They also interviewed all the people that attended the party that Karen went to that Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
The first person they spoke with was the person that brought Karen home from the party.
Oh, I forgot about that. Was mm-hmm. that a guy?
He was 24 years old and his name was William Mitchell.
Oh.
He was a farmhand at the time and a very small-time drug user. He revealed that he and Karen had gotten into a small fight at the party over what? Didn't say.
Drugs.
He did say that they left for Karen's house at 5 a.m., and he stayed at Karen's until 11 o'clock that Saturday morning.
Hmm.
Another person interviewed is a man that used to live at Karen's house, and I'm not sure if it was a partner of Karen's or just somebody
she knew.
Yes. He told the police that he did call Karen at 11:30 on Sunday night and then went to bed right after, but he didn't have any other alibi.
Hmm. Okay.
So then they learned that Karen was in a serious relationship and that they had recently broken up.
Oh.
So they brought in the ex-boyfriend. All the people that they interviewed willingly gave their fingerprints and samples of blood, saliva, hair, all that kind of good stuff. They collected samples from over 70 people.
Let me guess. The boyfriend wouldn't do it.
Before the investigation was over.
Mm-hmm. Let me guess. The boyfriend wouldn't give
Everybody
his.
Complied.
Oh, he did?
Everybody was
oh,
good. Okay. Everybody complied. Police did have semen samples that were left by the killer, but DNA was in its early stages.
Oh, yeah, beginning. Yep.
And it wasn't really used as it is now. Mm-hmm. It pretty much was only used to eliminate people than actually proving that they were guilty. Mm-hmm. So a few weeks after the murder, the police think they have a break in the case. The palm print found on the bedroom wall comes back with a match.
Ooh.
It's Bill Mitchell.
That's the 24-year-old? That's who I thought.
But he was a friend of Karen's and had been to her house many times before, including the day before the murders.
That's right.
Plus, they had also found other prints of his
in there too.
In the house. A few weeks later, the police get a hysterical phone call from the host of the party that Karen attended that mm-hmm. Friday before her death.
Mm-hmm.
The caller tells police that their house had been broken into and there's a lot of blood all over the floor. So the police rush over to the house and check it out. They soon find car keys and a wallet that belongs to Bill Mitchell. They begin to think that maybe he had been murdered because the amount of blood was, there's a lot of blood. Bill comes crashing in the house and he's naked except for this towel that's wrapped around his waist and blood is dripping onto the floor.
Okay.
Bill starts to tell the police that when he arrived at the house, three men appeared and dragged him inside. Bill starts to tell police the whole story of what happened. He says that when he arrived at this house, mm-hmm. three men just jumped out of nowhere and dragged him inside. Bill then explained the men told him they knew the host of the party had committed murders of Karen and her kids, and they wanted Bill to tell them the exact location where the host was.
So Bill is claiming that these vigilantes came to get and attacked him because they really wanted to go attack the host of the party?
Yeah, because they knew that the host of the party was the one that killed Karen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
buy it.
Yeah. Bill tried to explain that he had no idea where the host was, so the gang members took out a filleting knife and attempted to cut off Bill's penis. Bill then said he managed to escape and lock himself in the bathroom. After the three men left, he went outside and hid in the yard until the police arrived. So Bill is bleeding so badly that the police rush him to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
At the hospital, they go at Bill and they're questioning him really hard.
Was it severed?
And it was so intense. I don't believe it was severed.
Okay.
And the police were so intense with the questioning that Bill finally breaks down and admits that his story was a lie and that he tried to cut off his own penis.
Sorry, not funny.
But he said it was a suicide attempt. And that it was for personal reasons. So I don't know if the suicide was for personal reasons.
Do a lot of people attempt suicide from cutting off their genitals?
I don't think I've ever heard of a case.
I don't think I have either. Lorena Bobbitt.
That was an angry wife.
Oh, I know.
So anyway, police then charged Bill with making a false statement.
Mm-hmm.
Police soon found out that Bill Mitchell actually had mutilated himself at a camping ground or a caravan park. The owner of the caravan park went out to one of the caravans or RVs to clean it. I guess they rent them out. And he had found blood and semen splattered everywhere. Can you imagine what a wonderful job that must have been? He also found a pornographic magazine.
What?
That had been shredded with a razor blade. You know, the park owner immediately calls the police because I would too. He gives all the evidence. He bags it up and gives it to the police. But the police never make it public. And as far as we know now, Bill is just really unstable.
You think?
But there's really nothing connecting him to the murders, you know. And the police agree that he's unstable, but they can't find him a connection. One day, the police get news that the fingerprints on the door, you know, remember the greasy fingerprints? They're only fingertips. They're not full prints.
Oh.
So that means they have to go back and retake prints to make sure
they didn't miss them.
To make sure that they capture the tips of the fingers this time, because you can't match them without actual tip prints. But this time, luckily, there are only 25 people that the police consider suspect.
Is Bill one of them?
Mm-hmm.
Shocker.
And remember, everybody was very happy to give their samples and prints. Right. Instead of making everybody go to the police station, the police go to them. A detective heads out to the farm where Bill works, and he's retaking Bill's prints. And he's talking, you know, since Bill knew Karen, he's very interested in finding the killer and all that kind of stuff. So they're talking about that, and Bill makes a comment to the officer that he was surprised that the police were still investigating the murder.
Murders.
Well, murders, right.
Right.
Because he had heard that the man had been caught. The detective's, you know, just letting him talk. Bill said that he had heard the news that a man was acting odd at a caravan park and the police had got him. Well, that immediately made the detective stop. You know, bells started to go off. And he just realized that since that info had never been released to the public, Bill just outed himself as the murderer.
Oh, so that's why sometimes police officers know a lot more than they share with
us. Yeah, exactly.
Some ding dong comes along and gives himself
and gives away. Right. So, and don't forget the prints. Not only did Bill's prints match the one on the door, the results had come back from the chemist that they had a match to the lotion that was used on Karen's body.
In a crime.
And that proved that Bill was the murderer. The same substance was found on Karen that was on the
fingerprints. Yeah.
Got that? Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. Okay. So he had the same substance on his hands that she had, that he had used on her.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Proving that he was the murderer. Yeah. The detectives from Perth came down and they arrested Bill. They confronted him with the evidence.
Good.
And you know what? It doesn't take long and Bill confesses. Just confesses it all. He states that he remembers wanting to kill the family.
Why?
But he doesn't remember why he wanted them all dead. Yet he proceeded to tell the detectives every detail. He said that on Saturday after leaving Karen's house, Bill went back to the place where the party was held. That house, the party house. He started drinking heavily, smoking weed, swallowed tons of prescription pills, and even shot up amphetamines twice in the bathroom. And he stayed in that house until around 2:30 a.m. that Sunday night or Monday morning.
He was binging big time.
Yeah, I mean, he went from, let's see, he left Karen's at 11 on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And then he didn't leave until Monday morning at 2:30. And the entire time he was drinking and doing drugs.
So I have to swallow those words about the person being on drugs. And yeah.
Then he got in his car and he went to Karen's house at about 2:30 in the morning. Bill said by then he was in a drug-fueled stupor. He explained that when he got to the house and got out of his car, he immediately attacked Daniel with a hatchet. He then went to the house and killed Karen before raping her. And then Bill admitted that he went into both girls' rooms and killed them.
Why?
As part of his confession, the senior detectives took Bill Mitchell to the murder house. Bill gave the police a step-by-murderous-step account of what happened that night. He was so methodical, clinical, and emotionless when he gave this account that these detectives were appalled by how he could so callously relive this crime.
Mm-hmm.
They said that his description of killing Karen had the same amount of emotion as anyone would describe washing their car.
Ugh.
Bill then explained to detectives how he washed up and left the house, making sure to take the hatchet and the lotion and not to leave evidence. He also told them that he had thrown away the lotion in a dumpster and threw the tomahawk in the Grenif River on his way to the house back in Geraldton. So the next day, detectives called for divers to go to the Grenif River and search for the murder weapon. Remember, it's been 5 weeks since the murder, but when the hatchet was found and brought up from the bottom of the muddy, murky river bottom.
Yes.
The head of the axe.
Yes.
Still had hair.
Ooh, I knew you were
attached.
Gonna say that.
Ugh. That's bad.
No.
So on September of 1993, Bill Mitchell pled guilty to 4 counts of willful murder, 3 counts of indecently interfering with a dead body, and several unrelated counts of burglary using a syringe and knife.
What did he do with the syringe?
I don't know. Even though this is just so disgusting, here's my take on it. Even though the records of the deaths of the children were sealed, mm-hmm. the fact that he had 4 counts of murder and 3 counts of indecently interfering with a dead body.
Yeah, you don't need to explain it.
He must have
nope.
hurt those
we got
girls.
It. We yeah. got it. Yep.
Motherfucker. Seriously.
Has he done anything like this?
No.
How do people just wake up one day and say, I want to kill a family?
I have no idea. So at
there
his
has
trial.
To be signs.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention 48 hours of drug use.
So at the trial, Justice Neville Owen said the crimes were so serious it almost defied description. He said it was difficult for a person having any semblance of ordinary humanity to conceive how such a callous and brutal crime could be committed by a human being. The judge found the murders to be premeditated. He dismissed any defense based on Mitchell's intoxication and drug use and noted the clarity in Mitchell's recalling of the details of his confession. He said Mitchell had obviously been able to think and reason with precision during the killings, mm-hmm. which is true. He remembered everything.
See, and I said that he didn't.
Mm-hmm. If he was in some kind of stupor, he wouldn't have been able to recount anything. So in October, Mitchell was sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms, but he could be released on parole after 20 years time served.
No, right. He should never see the light of day outside of his cell.
But he also had strict security.
No.
So Judge Owen said the decision to grant that right of parole was the most difficult one that he had ever made, but he still decided to do it.
Why? I need to be a judge. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Trust me, the idea that he could be out in 20 years caused a huge public outcry.
As
I mean, these are people that wanted the death penalty brought back just for this case. It was awful. Petition was even sent to the Western Australian Parliament demanding that the death penalty be used for people like Bill. The government was pressured to change the ruling. The Crown launched an appeal and the parole was overturned, meaning that Mitchell would be jailed for life.
Good.
So then, twist.
Hope somebody gets him a prison.
Mitchell appeals and is reinstated to be able to apply for parole in 20 years.
Nope. What, is he just going to be rehabbed then? Like 20 years in and I'm a totally different person?
The High Court agreed that it would be hard to tell if Mitchell would still be a danger to society after 20 years' time. Mitchell's lawyer explained that life imprisonment is only for those that are truly, truly evil and have absolutely no hope to be rehabilitated. His defense was he didn't fall into that category. Mitchell wasn't truly evil and that he could be rehabilitated. It wasn't like he was a serial killer or anything. They also argued that once Mitchell was off drugs, he wouldn't be any kind of sexual or physical danger to the community anymore.
That's like saying Ted Bundy's a really nice guy. Let's give him a chance. Let's just try to keep him away from young college girls. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, he's a really nice guy.
Mitchell has been denied every time he's been up for parole.
Thank you.
His next parole hearing is in September of 2019. The cherry on top of this entire case.
So to say.
When Mitchell was confessing the murders, he admitted that Karen had refused his sexual advances when he took her home from the party. And he probably sat there and stewed.
Well, that right there tells me
that bitch doesn't want me. I'll show her. I'm just assuming that.
You don't want to assume. We talked about that one episode.
I know. But still, can you believe?
Well, here's the thing. I would say that what he did was really evil. And the fact that he sat and stewed about it and then did it, I would say that that's about as evil as you can get. And why kill the babies? Seriously. Not that it's okay that he killed her, but...
Well, and presumably he raped them, too.
I don't want to know that. I don't want to hear that.
No.
I'm going to pretend that I don't know that.
Right.
But the whole thing is, like, why... I mean... He killed them and Daniel for no reason, really.
Just because a woman told a man no,
right.
Four people in Griniff, Australia are dead. Mm. Horrible.
Horrible story. That's awful.
Isn't it awful?
I've never heard of that one.
I had just found it not too long ago, and I was floored. Absolutely floored. So sick.
And to chop off his calf.
And to try to...
It's terrible.
Yeah. He is a little bit... unstable.
A little bit. I'd say a lot bit.
I hope he never gets out of jail. That's all I can say.
That was
I kind of agree about the whole death penalty thing being brought back just for him.
Well, some people are truly evil, and obviously he's one.
Looks like he can hide it well.
So what do you have to tell the good people?
I have to tell them that I appreciate them listening.
Hey, if you like us, reach out, give us 5 stars. Also, if you write a review, hit us up, let us know, and we'll send you some stickers or something, or a new car.
Or not a new car, or maybe just stickers. But DM us and talk to us. I love talking to people on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @OurTrueCrimePod. Jen, run the main account. Camille has her own OTCP with Cam. You can chat her up, tell her what an awesome job she does with all the videos that she makes.
Also, we just figured out how to put them on YouTube.
Woohoo! We're on Spotify now.
And we also have a Facebook. You can check us out on Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast.
Please help us out with our LPE and do leave reviews for us or give us a shout out on Twitter.